So, first patient. In the UK, around 3,700 people at the moment find themselves in the situation of being denied asylum, but also without the ability to return to their quote, country of origin. They may not be able to return for a number of reasons. Perhaps their presumed country of origin doesn't recognize them or want to issue travel documents or a passport. There might be conflict there, or the person in question might be undergoing medical care that would be disrupted by repatriation. It's also very possible that a refused asylum seeker might have filed an appeal of their case, of their decision, and a roughly 25% of those who appeal an initial rejection receive asylum upon appeal. It's actually a pretty large number contributing to the overall approved asylum applications. Under Section 4 of the Immigration and Asylum Act, 1999, destitute refused asylum seekers, unable to return to their country of origin, can receive £35.39 per week on this blue card here. Refused asylum seekers receive this money through what the private contractor calls a motivation program, and the contractor running, owning and operating the card is Sodexo, a global life services company that specializes in outsourcing of all kinds. So if you look at their global portfolio, you'll be very quickly overwhelmed at the number of locations and institutions they work in, including prisons and detention centers as well. Section 4 support is contingent upon the destitution of the applicant and housing in the UK's No Choice Dispersal Program, a program that relocates destitute asylum seekers and refused asylum seekers away from London primarily to less expensive housing, basically. So in order to be eligible for this form of support, one has already to be or claim to be without family or community resources to draw upon and without savings. Of course, people in the process of and refused from asylum have not had the right to work for some time, and so they don't have the opportunity to provide for themselves in this situation. The Azure card is remarkable in that, and different from other forms of support, in that it's a cashless benefit system. So the reason that it's on this card and not in the form of vouchers or cash dispersal is to create a situation in which Section 4 recipients never have access to cash. So this creates all kinds of certain kinds of pressures on recipients. Refused asylum seekers are the only group to receive cashless card-based benefits in the UK, and in fact, a pilot program offering card-based benefits to benefits recipients in Newcastle had only 16 voluntary participants, and so the plan was scrapped. There's a general, sort of like anecdotally and talking to people, there's a feeling that the surveillance mechanisms that are included with the card are too invasive and perhaps rather obvious to anyone who signs up for it. So there's a general resistance to card-based benefits. The card can only be used at, can only be used at retailers who have paid to participate in the program, which you see here, and you'll note that discount and local grocers are not included here, though in recent years, charity shops like the Red Cross and the Salvation Army have been added, and local shops can apply to participate, and refuse asylum seekers can apply to have local halal shops, for example, participate as well, but their admittance to the program is at the discretion of the Home Office. And so it's not pervasive. The card cannot be used to buy bus or train tickets, and No Choice housing can be quite far from accepted retailers, particularly in new dispersal areas, which are in smaller towns and small cities where housing is cheaper. And so the larger, cheaper shops can be farther from where people are located. The No Choice housing or the dispersal program considers 3 miles from home to shops to be an acceptable distance, so that shopping at these accepted retailers could require, in theory, a 6 mile round trip. So for those with children, to go on this kind of weekly shopping trip could be quite taxing. And the bar on transportation also prevents people from visiting family and children in other parts of the United Kingdom, and this creates particular difficulties for those with trying to establish close family ties and close relationships as part of their legal appeal of their refusal. A 2014 Red Cross report found that 92% of its respondents had difficulties traveling to visit family in the UK due to lack of money, and 89% had difficulties traveling to visit members due to the long distances. So the policy, Section 4 support, is envisioned to be short-term, a short-term solution for people who are on their way out. But as you can see here, and as a number of previous reports have shown, people actually live on the Azura card for pretty extended periods of time. And the effects of this, of enforced destitution and the lack of transportation and cashlessness, mount over time as families and single individuals find themselves without the ability to cope with the small emergencies that are just part of everyday life, illnesses and mundane requests for cash at school, for example, if someone has kids, visits to the doctor, visits to legal counsel, and so on and so forth. So destitution is a requirement to access housing and food, and destitution is enforced by the situation itself through low levels of support and by its cashlessness. Living on the Azura card embeds people in an assemblage of mobility constraints and requirements, all of which are aimed at creating a deterrent effect or expelling people from the United Kingdom. It should be recognized that destitution can be more dire for those without Section 4 support, so not all refused asylum seekers are on receive this form of support, as they either work without papers and without protections, or they rely entirely on charity and family. But their mobilities and transactions are not monitored in the same way as Section 4 recipients. And so I think it's worth noting the ways in which the surveillance mechanisms of the Azura card are built into this form of support. I would also argue that that form of cashlessness doesn't necessarily make them more free, but they're also constrained through a lot of the same economic mechanisms that are at work in the Azura card. So I think we should ask how the institutional and technical elements of these different statuses organize people's ability to reproduce themselves, care for each other, and envision a future. And this sort of ability to do those things is something that I think pervades carceral geographies and prison literature more broadly. So the sort of removal of time and removal of the future is something you hear over and over again in prison ethnographies. So taking up Gill, Moran, Conlon, and Burridge's recent conceptualization of carceral circuits, I want to think through the meta-institutional, as they call it, geographies of life on the Azura card. And doing so allows me to draw out the carcerality of the Azura card, but also to ask if and how we might conceptualize particular carceral geographies of asylum. That is, given the nominal constraints placed on detention of asylum seekers, have states developed policies that respatialize incarceration to produce its effects in ways that comply with human rights regulations and certain bars on formal imprisonment? Gill, Moran, Conlon, and Bridge offer six epistemological starting points for analyzing the relations, quote, the relations between people's objects and practices journeys, and the more than institutional systems of capital and value creation that drive them. Such an approach, they write, quote, foregrounds connections over discrete and compartmentalized ways of understanding incarceration, providing a corrective to the popular institutionalist perception of the sealed off nature of carceral spaces, end quote. In other words, they advocate focusing on the relationships that compose confinement, a topology of confinement rather than a defined topography. I understand them to mean that we should be analyzing prisons from the perspective of connections, mobilities, and relationships as well, the very materialities that prison is presumed to subtract from human life. Okay, so the six points are, first, a circuit is travel between places and return to the original place. Second, a circuit is a route along which things pass. So it's an activity and it is like a surface. Third, carceral circuits are components of larger systems. And so, and I think particularly important is acknowledging the ways in which carceral circuits connect up with non-carceral ones, perhaps rely on them. Once within a circuit, movement is compulsory. And carceral, and they also take up the meaning of circuitous as obfuscatory, oblique, and tortuous. Okay, so utilizing the politics of visibility and invisibility that are always at play in carceral geographies. And then finally, these circuits can be countermapped to precisely to open up and make visible that which has been invisibilized. So these are takes or starting points which are useful for identifying overlapping circuits, I think. So I think they can coexist and open up different angles of the same same policy. The refused, so what I'd like to do here is sort of do a reading of the Azura card through this rather than sort of apply it to the Azura card. So the refused asylum seeker is imagined in the act of refusal to be on their way home. If not voluntarily, then they will be nudged and encouraged through the paced removal of capacities to build a future. We can think of this circuit as a teleology of return, and the Azura card as both a nudge and a kind of ironic acceptance of the impossibility of return for many. The combination of no-choice dispersal policies, Azura cards accepted retailers, and the lack of bus fare coverage places people on certain journeys and paths, mundane but sometimes grinding journeys to more expensive shops. These routes are routinized by the weekly disbursement of credits of the £35, 39 pence, and in the past by the prohibition of savings. The routes and routines are embedded in other everyday demands that are stymied by cashless life. A few pounds for the school trip, medicine for a winter flu, a haircut, or going to car boot sales. Drawing on Conlon and Hamstra's work on produced deprivation and detention, we can also see the active involvement of for-profit organizations in multiple layers of reproduction as a kind of financialization of waiting. In other words, migrant time here is capitalized, as Ruben Anderson argues, and as such, it is a source of accumulation by dispossession, as Carmelin and Hamstra argue, and the conduit and a conduit for financial flows from states to security firms like G4S, life services firms like Sodexo and Jomast, and humanitarian service providers as well. This time, migrant time, is routinized by weekly credit dispersal as well as by language classes, open days at organizations, and home office reporting requirements. This teleology of return, routes and routines are linked up are not only by everyday comings and goings, but by networks of contractual relationships between the home office, G4S, and its subcontractors, these networks produce circuits of money and expertise. Transaction data from Azura cards can move between Sodexo and its transaction data subcontractor and the home office. For private firms, these flows of money are capital and they circulate within firms between investors and shareholders. The volume of that circulation is valued in stock prices. Expertise in the capitalization of migrant time and reproduction produces its own value, realized in the form of renewed contracts and new contracts. These financial circuits are difficult to visualize and are highly abstracted from the roots and routines of people living on the Azura card. But they form an increasingly important part of this meta-institutional carceral geographies. So my goal in this paper has been to question the boundaries of carceral geographies, not just the boundaries of scholarship, but the ways in which boundaries and enclosures operate alongside circulation, connectedness, and relationships. And identifying particular kinds of relationships, mobilities, and connections, or circuits, of incarceration, could we also analyze other situations for their less apparent carcerality? And I think we have a couple sessions this afternoon that try to do just this. Put another way, can we trace the topological relations of carceral spaces absent the topographies of walls, fences, and cells? I'd like to argue that the specific juridical political position of asylum and refugee regulations and their limitations on the use of incarceration has led some states to embed carceral circuits in homes, neighborhoods, and everyday reproductive activities like grocery shopping. And let us be clear that detention and incarceration are, of course, still very important components of immigration and border enforcement throughout the world. And it is precisely, I think, speaking for myself, the spectacular and highly visible character of these obvious carceral spaces that may blind us to the unpacking and recombining of carceral circuits for other asylum seekers, and in particular for refused asylum seekers. So I think here also of Greek and Italian hotspots as well, that process, identify, select, and illegalize, and they also make use of island topographies to control migrant mobilities without imprisonment. I also think of the proliferation of card-based benefit schemes internationally. So next year, Section 95 asylum support will go onto a card. There are similar programs in certain areas of Italy and Jordan, and iris scan debit technologies at work in some refugee camps, which are actually cardless, so it's just biometric banking, I suppose. Because the UK's Azure card will be replaced next year by the Aspen card, which is also owned and managed by Sodexo, it's important to ask how these geographies of refused asylum will change once some of these pressures on mobility are lifted. But it's also important to understand the ways in which destitution works, like Conlon and Heimstra's produced deprivation, as a way of divesting asylum seekers not only of financial resources, but of the social relations and support those financial resources represent. That the resource itself, the labor, is reproductive and unpaid and cashless, however, indicates a certain flow of some of these circuits, and distribution of money as being an important part of sustaining these circuits. And it also reveals the production of destitution as an extractive practice, the production of Denning's wageless life through a series of legal and administrative techniques of illegalization. For if imprisonment is the denial of the liberal right to personal autonomy, then cashlessness is the denial of participation in the economy. And what could be a more perfect casting out from a marketized neoliberal society than cashlessness? Thank you.